From the start, when it was an instrument of the wood god Pan, the flute has been associated with pure, some might say impure, energy. Its sound releases something naturally untamed, as if a squirrel were let loose in a church. It's a description of the flute by Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
How old is the flute, and why is it one of the most popular instruments of all time? What are some of the special features of this instrument, and which composers have used it the most effectively? Joining us for an exploration of the flute is Stephanie Jutt, professor of music at the UW-Madison School of Music, founding member of the Bach Dancing and Dynamite Society, and principal flutist with the Madison Symphony Orchestra.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have you and your flutes here, and I say flutes plural, as you've brought two, and then you'll be playing them somewhere along the line again. And we'll also have some examples of other flutes and flute players. Well, when we ask about the origins of the instrument, you almost think, well, it must go back into the mists where somebody with pointed ears and furry feet, you know.
It certainly does go back into the mists.
Tripping through the woods.
And that's probably not too far off, actually. One teacher of mine had a flute that he owned. I forgot where he got it, but it was a bone. And a man would make a flute out of his wife's shin bone when she died. Ooh. And play on it in memory of his departed loved one, traditionally a wife, apparently. So I think that flute is well known to be maybe, and drums, you know, the most ancient instrument that we have, is certainly the easiest one to make.
Well, what counts as a flute then? Because I'm thinking, you know, sometimes you have whistles and recorders, and what makes it a flute?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, different people have different definitions of that word, flute. So when you play a recorder, I wish I had one with me, you don't have a hole that you blow over the way we do on a flute. Now, what I think of as a flute, or what we think of today as a flute is a tube that has a head joint on it or a top piece that has a hole that you blow over like a Coke bottle. So you make your sound by blowing over the top of a hole. And some of the air goes inside the hole and some of it goes over the hole. And that splitting of the air column is what makes the sound on the instrument. So anything where you blow over the top of a hole is considered a flute. There are many other kinds of flutes, though, around the world, of course. There are flutes that are called flutes that have reeds in them. There are flutes that have those kind of recorder head pieces that you blow past something that's actually buzzing or moving. There are flutes that are made out of all kinds of materials, too. Any kind of material could make a flute. You can make a flute out of a plastic straw on your dinner table very easily. So you can really make a flute out of anything. PVC pipe, you name it.
But shin bone.
Shin bone.
If you're going to get more than one note out of it, you have to have some kind of
elaboration. You have to have a few other holes in it to use with your fingers. But anybody can make one.
Well, if we go back to the sort of earliest music that we've got with flutes and maybe back to the Baroque era, for example, printed music, what kind of flute would have been used? How is it different from the modern flute?
Well, in the history of Western flute, which is what we're mostly going to be talking about today, in the history of Western flutes, the flutes were not used as solo instruments very much at all. They were more ensemble instruments. They were used to fill out the color in the ensemble. But one of our earliest and most important flute composers is Johann Sebastian Bach. He wrote a number of very virtuosic flute sonatas that were meant to be played with one unaccompanied one and a number of them with cello or viola da gamba and harpsichord. And in those days, flutes were always made out of wood, of some kind of wood. Every once in a while, you'd see ones made out of ivory, and in Mozart's day, as he came along, you've seen there are some glass flutes. But basically, they were made out of wood, all different kinds of wood, and they only had one key. So it's interesting to hear how well these virtuosic musicians of the day could play these highly chromatic, difficult pieces by J.S. Bach that still challenge, you know, flutists today with all the keys that we've got on our instruments. So maybe we could start out by listening to one of the most famous Baroque flute players in the world, Bartol Kuiken, on a Bach sonata, the Sonata in A Major, the first movement of that. So you can see the sound of the Baroque flute is something that we're not really used to hearing anymore. I would say a general audience wouldn't have necessarily heard Baroque flute as part of their background at all. And you can hear that, and especially when we contrast it with pieces that we're about to play, how much softer and gentler the sound is of the Baroque flute from our modern day silver flutes. And I think the whole concept of sound has changed so drastically over the years, from this sound that you just heard to what we're used to when we hear somebody like James Galway play today. Mm-hmm. So really the evolution of the flute is really an evolution of sound. That's what we hear when we go through all the ages of flute playing. And this, again, this is what we call transverse flute, which is the kind of flute that goes out horizontally from your head rather than vertically like a recorder. A transverse flute is a flute that you play over the mouthpiece mm-hmm. hole, like I was describing.
From the side rather than the end.
From the side. Thank you. From the side. Like a transverse, yes. To the side rather than vertically. And the history of this evolution, it's really more about trying to play louder and louder and louder.
Yeah, I noticed the one you just played. It's a soft, mellow
very
sound.
Soft, very mellow, and, you know, but rich still, you know, in
right.
its overall sound. It never sounds puny. It's just softer.
It's a relatively small room, relatively small
all those
audience.
Things, all those things. And I had this great experience. I was able to attend a performance of a Mark Morris ballet last Christmas time in Berkeley. And it was a piece by Handel. And it was an all Baroque instrument orchestra. And this was in Zellerbach Hall in Berkeley. So it's a nice, you know, big, you know, Alice Tully size concert hall. And when you first heard this orchestra, and, you know, everybody's playing on gut strings on the string instruments, you know, and of course the flutes are these, you know, one-keyed Baroque flutes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all on down the line. The sound was so much softer. I thought, oh, I was going deaf or something like that. I thought, gee, you know, where's the sound? Where's the sound? And then, you know, over the course of, let's say, a minute, just took about 1 minute, my ears adjusted so that it stopped sounding soft to me and it started sounding normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized how jacked up our ears have gotten over the years, that we're used to hearing this big, bold, aggressive, let's say even, sound. And however mellow you make a flute sound, a modern virtuoso flute player has got a big sound that will fill a 2,000-seat hall.
Has to.
So our concept of sound has just evolved with the development of halls. And the repertoire has followed along suit, you know, with the development of the instrument, the development of the halls. All these things go together, and they end up being the evolution of a sound over time.
I was thinking it must be fun. I realize fun isn't a professional word, but it must be fun to
it
have quite a repertoire in terms of kinds of music, kinds of flutes that you as a flutist could draw on. Can you give us a contrast to the one we just heard of something that, you know, obviously you could get a Baroque flute and play something like the Bach you just played. What's another kind of example of something very, very different?
Let's say I would give you an example here, a little short example of what I would call a quintessential modern sound. And this is Mark Sparks, principal flutist in the St. Louis Symphony right now, playing the Gobert Madrigal flute and piano. So that piece was written by Philippe Gobert, who was probably the most famous French flutist in the late 1800s. And he taught at the Paris Conservatory. And he is one of the few people I could name, you know, that we would say, yes, he's one of the fathers of the sound that we play with today as flute players, as Western style, you know, classical flute players. Philippe Gobert was extremely influential, and Mark Sparks, this flute, is a perfect component of that kind of a sound.
We're going to talk about how we got from the earlier sounding wooden flute with one key to the more modern sounding flute in a moment when we continue with University of the Year.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Chippewa Valley Technical College. Openings now available for nano and micro machining tenants at the NanoRite Incubation and Innovation Center. More information at nanorite.org.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Stephanie Jutt. We're talking about the flute. We've heard two recordings so far. One was with the Baroque flute, a wooden flute, one key, kind of a mellow, soft sound. And then we heard a more modern sounding flute, more like what we're used to hearing today. What happened in between, and how are they really different?
What a great question. It took hundreds of years to really have this happen. But really, looking back on it, it seems like it was a blink of an eye, because flute players who only had one key were constantly frustrated because it was so hard to do some of the notes. Like, one note would sound like la, and the other note would sound like, you know, because half of the keys were covered up. So they kept adding keys randomly. Like, one flute maker in one town would add this key so you could play an A flat, great, you know. And then another flute player in another town would add this other key so you could play B flat or something. So this kept going on for, you know, 100 years or more. And finally, in the middle of the 1800s, somebody who was actually a contemporary of Philippe Gobert, Theobald Böhm, and he was a Swiss watchmaker. He was like a jeweler, I guess you could say, and clockmaker. And he, because he was a fabulous mechanic, he fashioned a system for playing, a new fingering system, brand new fingering system for playing the flute that made the flute, it made it possible to play the flute chromatically without drastically altering the sound of the instrument from note to note.
And then enable you to play in any key then.
You know how on harp they have those old Irish harps, they're like in C and they're in F. Okay, that's the little two keys you get. And then it evolved to the chromatic harp where they have all those pedals on the bottom, but they can play a chromatic scale. So it's sort of the same thing with a flute. This fingering system allowed flute players to make a consistent sound all the way up and down the scale chromatically. And that was something that had never been done before. And I don't know about the other wind instruments, just how difficult it is for them to make a chromatically smooth sound, to make their sound consistent from note to note. But I know that this was a breakthrough moment for flute players, and that very soon after this is like in the 1850s, that flute players all over Europe were switching to this Böhm flute. And with that switch, they began to switch from wood to silver. And silver was found to be a very projecting, resilient, warm sound. And especially the flute players in France, like Philippe Gobert, were switching to flutes made out of silver. And there was one very famous flute maker named Louis Lotte, who championed this new fingering system by Theobald Böhm. And everybody wanted his flutes. And I'll tell you how much people really want those flutes, even today in England. And I'm not kidding. This is really true. People are paying $25,000 to $30,000 for these Louis Lotte flutes that were made back in the 1800s. And they're much flatter because, of course, as sounds have gotten bigger, pitch has also gone up over the ages. So our pitch today, where, let's say, an A used to be 420, you know, revolutions per second or whatever it is, and now it's 440 or 442. I've heard Berlin, it's 448, you know.
To get a particularly bright sound.
As instruments have gotten higher and higher in pitch, they've gotten louder and louder too. But people want these old Louis Lotte flutes. So they buy them and then they spend a fortune having the holes recut.
Wow.
And moved.
So that's great for a generation or two.
Yeah, they put solder into the holes to kind of shore it up on one side and drill it out on the other side of the hole. So basically they're making the whole instrument a teeny tiny bit shorter to make it a teeny tiny bit higher.
It makes it kind of useless as an original instrument too, doesn't it?
Well, they don't care. They they have this sound. And it's interesting, those Louis Lotte flutes were made, a lot of them, before they were able to make an actual tube out of silver. So they were a flat piece of silver that was curved around and soldered to make a tube. So all these people who love Louis Lotte flutes swear up and down that there's this mysterious something that those flutes have that nobody else has. And I can tell you, they are very, very beautiful. They sound great, even today. So maybe flutes haven't really changed that much since the 1850s. That was really, like I said, the breakthrough moment. There have been some notable, you know, improvement since then, but that was the big one for us.
And the flute you have here, if you play it, let's say you play Bach on it, as compared to if you were playing the same Bach piece with a Baroque flute, what is it that you can do other than having a consistent tone as you change your, you know, as you use chromatic notes and so on? What else can you do that you couldn't have done before?
Well, I think that that can be something our listener can decide. I'll play a movement of a Bach sonata on my modern flute, which is made out of silver, made by a woman flute maker in this country named Lillian Burkhardt. It's a great instrument. And I have this recording of Bartol Quiquend, the great Baroque flute player, playing the same movement on the Baroque flute. So you'll hear the difference. You'll hear how much louder my flute is, how much more of a percussive quality I can get out of the articulation, and let's just say more dynamic range, possibly, because I can play soft and I can play quite loud on my modern flute. And the softness to loudness range is not as big on the Baroque flute. But I think I have to sacrifice some of the beautiful color of the wooden flute that I can never get on my modern silver flute.
Well, which are we going to hear first?
I'll play first.
Okay.
So this is the Bourée movement from the Partita in A minor by Johann Sebastian Bach. And now we'll contrast that with Bartol Quiquend playing the same movement, the Sonata in A minor by J.S. Bach. Thank you.
How many composers over the course of time wrote for just flute? No harpsichord, no piano, no orchestra.
Well, actually, very many. Because a flute has always been something that people like to put in their back pocket, basically. These old-fashioned flutes, you know, before Böhm made this fingering system, would have lots of different middle sections. So you'd have the top piece that you blew through, and then you have the bottom, little bottom piece. But the middle section was different, and there was one for every key. So if you go over to your friend's house and you want to play, oh, I want to play this song. I know it in G. Oh, out comes your middle section in G, you know, the one that'll play in that key. And so people had like a whole bunch of different little pieces that they could interchange and play different music on them. So nobody had to be very good. And that's nice because it was an instrument that was beloved by many people who were not rich. It was an instrument that was popular with poor people as well as with the landed gentry and that sort of thing.
Changes that Böhm instigated in the mid-19th century with the, you know, chromatic flute. Mm-hmm. How did that change the way composers wrote for the instrument?
Well, that's a great question. It made it possible to write very virtuosic works with lots and lots of notes, and it made it possible for people to play loudly enough to be heard over a piano.
Or an orchestra.
So flutes became even more popular because people played them at home, of course, but then they were also these sort of traveling virtuosos, itinerant musicians who were, you know, really, really fabulous players. And they wrote a lot of pieces, opera fantasies, hundreds and hundreds of opera fantasies are written, many of them by Böhm, actually, where they'll take a popular tune like Carnival of Venice. You know, you'll have these pieces that go a million miles an hour based on these tunes that people knew.
Raises another question. How did breathing change when all these other innovations arrived?
Oh, that's a good question, too. Well, I think flute players have always had to have a lot of breath control. Maybe it just got further accentuated because we were expected to make so much more sound. And there's nothing
bigger
on the flute that keeps the air from coming out. I mean, it's just you and that hole.
It's kind of like whistling,
so
almost.
It's like singing is more probably the vocal apparatus is the closest to flute playing. All the other instruments have some kind of resistance with a reed
something
or whatever.
To sustain the
or a
note.
Mouthpiece or a brass thing, you know, something that'll keep that air from coming out. So with a flute player, you have to keep it inside your body and you sort of dole it out to yourself depending on how long you want to try and play.
Now, where does the circular breathing come in? Is that a fairly new thing?
That is a new thing, and that's kind of a trick. You know, it's kind of a circus trick, basically. And I have not learned how to do it because I haven't been convinced that its effectiveness is really necessary. But that's where you can blow out the air in your mouth while you're breathing in.
You keep it going almost indefinitely.
But invariably, I hear people doing it, and they'll be playing a note that sounds like this. It'll go.
Uh-huh.
You know, you hear them try to kind of keep it going, but it doesn't sound
good. It's hard to maintain a constant pressure.
One thing that has become much more popular, and I've done in lots and lots of contemporary music, is singing and playing at the same time. So a very famous piece by George Crumb that you may know is called The Voice of the Whale.
Yes.
Opens with a flute cadenza that sounds like this. So you can just
sing. That's weird sounding.
Yeah, it's a weird, creepy.
Well, it's kind of like whistling and
it's kind of like a kazoo. It's kind of like singing through a comb with wax paper on it. And then another thing we've learned how to do more recently is make noises on the flutes like a percussion instrument, like, you know, hitting your keys really hard and making this sort of a sound. Or another
people
one
like
I learned this year in a piece I did that you have to go like this.
So you hear like a pitch. So you can, you pop your keys
more of a percussion
and you can make
instrument.
Like a sound.
Yeah.
We also do things like we've learned how to make our flutes, our modern flutes, a little bit more like the Baroque flutes and try to learn how to bend keys by bending our fingers. You know, and there are lots of pieces where we have to bend notes. And just depending on how much you want to bend it, you have to learn to bend your fingers and slide them off the hole and do all kinds of funny, fantastic things to try and make it sound more like a glissando the way a clarinet or a saxophone
now
can
you
do.
Now, you have two instruments you've brought. You have a big flute as well. You didn't bring a piccolo, which we've all seen and heard.
Well,
the very
you don't
high...
want that in the studio, believe me.
But can you tell us about this larger
sure.
instrument?
Sure. This is an alto flute, and it plays – it's bigger than a C flute that I usually play is in C. And the alto flute is in G, below C. So it plays down fourth below. So it'll go play down to low G. My lowest note on my regular flute is here. But the alto flute – I'm going to continue on alto flute right now. I'm going to go down to my lowest note. So it's a totally different color. So to give you a little idea on how differently these instruments sound, here's a little bit of that syrinx that I did before on the regular flute. Then on alto flute. So it's a really beautiful, rich, juicy sound. The thing about the alto flute is the keys are really big. I mean, they're about the same size of, say, a baritone saxophone. So your fingers are pretty spread apart when you're playing the alto flute, and it's not very easy to play anything fast on the alto flute.
It sounds like a flute that's lost its innocence.
Too much smoking.
Too much smoking. Lowered its voice. Well, it's a big round. I mean, you can see it's a much bigger round. The tube is a lot larger in general, and I have to really stretch my right arm out to play this instrument. So you can't play it for too long unless you're a big guy, you know, and then your arm will start to hurt from stretching it. But it's a gorgeous sound. So used properly, it's very effective. And a lot of composers have written special pieces for this instrument as well.
But you get less of that original evocation of, say, the panpipes than you do with the smaller flute.
I think so. I think you're right about that. And of course, that the evocation of the panpipes makes you think of those real little I guess they are called panpipes that are vertical that you blow, but you also blow over the top with those. So I think this evolution of sound over the years from, let's say, the 1600s till now really wouldn't be complete without listening to at least one piece played by James Galway, who is the person who I grew up and who was my hero after Jean-Pierre Rampal. Jean-Pierre Rampal was the person who put flute on the map.
The first superstar.
He was the first superstar, and he was hired by Columbia Artists Community Concert Series to go out across America in all kinds of small venues and playing this virtuosic flute music, which include a lot of these opera fantasies and other pieces, many pieces that were written for him. And so he was, when I was a little girl, I listened to him all the time. But as I became a teenager and into college, James Galway was the person who we listened to and who we all tried to copy. And I would say that among all the flute players of this century, he has revolutionized the flute sound and made it the biggest and boldest that it has ever been. He was trained. He went to music school in London and became the principal flutist of the Berlin Philharmonic at a pretty young age, completely driven as a player, revolutionary in his way, in his concept of sound. I think he sort of takes all the best of both worlds and pulls it all into one big, gorgeous, powerful instrument. These days, I would say for his playing is kind of almost a caricature of itself because this extreme use of vibrato, I would say, is not as tasteful as it used to be. So the selection I want to play from him is something that was recorded back in 1975 when he was first became a superstar, what I would say, when you could find a 4-foot-high cardboard statue of him in a music store like at Tower Records when he first became famous. And this is a recording that he made with Martha Argerich, with a great pianist who's one of my idols, of the César Franck Sonata. This is a piece that was so popular for violin, but he made it famous on the flute. And he was the first person to really make this piece famous. So let's play the recitative movement that shows the really dramatic sound that he brings to this instrument.
Boy, that's really a great sound. That's a sound that I grew up with and that we all tried to emulate as young players, at least my generation of players. That very bold, rich, completely yummy sound.
It does win you over. I mean, if you're used to thinking of that as a violin sonata, which it is, and at first you think, wait a minute, where's my violin? And then it
then you forget
so
all about
many,
violin.
Yeah, so many different nuances to the sound of that flute.
He's played flutes made out of different materials, too. We were just talking a minute ago about flutes made out of wood. He plays flutes made out of gold, flutes made out of platinum. And then nowadays, they're starting to make flutes that have a layer of another metal on top of something. So you might have silver that has platinum. It's called platinum clad. And just like your cookware, right? And they're experimenting with lots of different, like carbon fiber is really a big new thing. Something called aramite. It's a new composite that makes a sound that's got some gold in it. You know, so you don't have to use too much gold. You can use a little bit of gold. And all these make different sounds. Of course, you can always tell it's this certain player. If you had heard Galway playing on 10 different flutes, yes, he would have a different sound on everyone. But you would always know that it was him.
More on the flute when we continue in a moment on University of the Year.
Something you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio makes a connection to an idea that's important in your life. If you need more information, chances are you'll find it on our website, wpr.org, at your service on the web.
Tadeu Coelho was the Brazilian flutist there. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest is Stephanie Judge. She's talking us through the evolution of sound as that sound came out through the flute over the centuries. And in this recent time, we come into all kinds of nationalities represented by the sound of the flute.
That's right. The flute is so versatile. That's what makes it such a fun instrument for people. I think it is... Well, I shouldn't say it's more versatile than other instruments, but it adapts itself to so many different styles and so many different cultures. So people who love flute playing can love flute playing from India, from, you know, Native American music to South American panpipes to any kind of everything in between. I just don't think that there's anything you can do wrong on the flute, basically, except maybe try and play it too loud.
Or be a beginning flute player where you hear is...
No, it even sounds good as a beginner. In fact, that's one of the reasons my mother picked it, is because she didn't want to be totally annoyed.
You belong to... I helped found the Bach Dancing and Dynamite Society that does not just Bach, but all kinds of things, including that piece we just heard a little of, the one by Eduardo Gamboa, in the sort of modern Latin style. What other kinds of contemporary music have you performed for the and recorded for the flute?
Well, we record and perform music that's written every year. New music. One of our favorite composers is Paul Schoenfield, who you all know so well. He's a composer from Cleveland who's a fantastic pianist, and he's written some of the most accessible and exciting music, just in the same way that this Gamboa piece for flute and string quartet is really fun to listen to, is written by a Mexican composer in a folk style. You know, the flute is so adaptable to all these different folk styles, and it's instantly recognizable as a folk instrument to everyone. I think Paul Schoenfield uses the flute in a similar kind of a way to play sort of what I would call, you know, the American characteristic style, kind of almost, well, Tin Pan Alley is what this is called. He wrote a wonderful set of pieces called Four Souvenirs for Flute and Piano. It was originally for violin, and I did an adaptation. So Tin Pan Alley is a little song back from the day when Tin Pan Alley was famous, and I think that he is able to use this very American style to great advantage using the flute.
That was the work of Paul Schoenfeld from his latter-day works. In fact, Postcards from Madison, the name of the collection there, mm-hmm. and that was Tin Pan Alley with our guest, Stephanie Jutt, the flutist, and the pianist there was Jeffrey Sykes. Flutist or flautist?
Oh, definitely flutist.
I used to
That's
say,
a great question,
if
though.
People are playing the flout, then they're flautists.
That's right. You're so right about that. Yeah, that the flute is something that people always associate with gentleness, I think, and with fluidity. And in fact, my teacher, Marcel Moise, would always say, the flute, she is a beautiful queen, but she is only a queen. And what he meant by that is don't try and overblow the instrument. Don't try and make it do what it was not meant to do. But the flute has developed. Its sound has developed so much since Marcel Moise was alive and since he was growing up that maybe it would be exciting just to end with one movement from the Lowell Lieberman Flute Sonata, which is one of the most gangbuster, rip-roaring flute pieces that was ever written. And it's a contemporary piece. It's a young American composer. This piece was written, I want to say, around 1995, maybe. He's become a very popular flute composer, Lowell Lieberman, and he wrote this sonata for my flute teacher, my former flute teacher, Paula Robeson. And it's just terribly exciting, and it does not obey any of the rules at all. And the flute sounds like a tiger. In fact, she says, when you play this piece, you should feel like you're on the back of a very, very fast horse, but you're the one who's driving the horse, not the horse driving you.
Flute as provider of various special effects.
I know, absolutely.
As written into that sonata by Lowell Lieberman, and Goran Markusson was the flutist for that wild ride.
And Stephanie Jutt has been our guest. Thank you for guiding us through the world of the flute with such passion.
Oh, thank you. It's just the tip of the iceberg.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.